It is the duty of leaders to lead, of the creative to create, of the daring to do. The free world expects leadership of us. Its fate and our fate depends upon our leadership. We are industrious, inventive, restless, with the fires that burn within us. Well, I say that nothing is easy, and the best things are the hardest. And all our troubles, all our immense difficulties, now and in the future, can I say, be solved if we have the will, the courage. The future is to those who take it.
We thought today it would be appropriate to invite Anish Chopra back. Back because it was on this stage, although a bigger stage in the main hall, where we announced Startup Health, and it was Anish's energy, and it was Todd's energy, that allowed us to use that as a launching pad to inspire now 25,000 batteries included innovators from all around the world to join the Startup Health movement. And it's incredible to see the work that's being done by Esther Dyson in communities all around the U.S. And I was talking to Anish about some of the exciting things he's working on around opening up data. And we're going to have a conversation with Anish. We're going to allow you to have a conversation with Anish. And I would like you to join me in welcoming the former Chief Technology Officer of the United States of America, Anish Chopra.
All right, here we go. All right. What's up, man? Thank you. Batteries included. That is an awesome metaphor. I love it. Absolutely love it. Hi, everybody. Okay.
So, Anish.
Let's have some fun.
I remember when we first sat down. I think, in fact, it was at the White House.
It was.
On the eve of Datapalooza 2011. And there was about a dozen of us in the room, I think. It was the second year of Datapalooza. Can you describe a little bit about what was going on in 2011 with the environment?
Because I really want to set the context.
Yeah, so it started off with the State of the Union and the president's, I guess it was January of 2011, he issued this call to action. Really, it was called the Startup America Partnership. And the idea was, if you looked at all the data, the economic story of America for the last 30 years has been one of startups. That is to say, all net new job creation in the United States going back 30 years had come from companies less than 5 years old. In other words, while we've had big companies grow and shrink, small businesses stand up for the first time on Main Street and close on Main Street, most of that activity netted out. But businesses under 5 years old were an important source of net job creation. And so the economists on the president's staff suggested that we could do some things, some call to action, some reduced barriers in the macro sense for raising capital, but also to think about specific sectors, not unlike your wonderful wheel of innovation ingredients, where we could be much more active as a catalyst. And health was obviously at the top of the list. So when Todd and I had heard that you were organizing this program, we thought, what a beautiful way to align with the president's larger vision of Startup America and to find ways in which we can collaborate, reducing some of the barriers, opening up as much government data that could be fuel for those startups. And with the transition, what we knew was coming with payment reform, really juice, if you will, the industry's demand for the resulting products and services. And there was a Stanford professor, just to kind of get into the weeds for one moment, that said there's two ways to think about growing an ecosystem. One is you shine lots of light, and so you can celebrate people who've done great work, and that could be an important way for incubators and accelerators to play a role. And the other is to find new business models that are emerging because the industry is shifting, and you catch that wave before the incumbents do. And I think you really represented a movement to draw attention to where the waves are going, and that's given a lot of the startups in this community a head start on perhaps some of those that may have been more of the batteries not included crowd.
So this industry has no shortage of people who are resistant to innovation. I want to go back a little bit, back to 2010, 2011. There was less than $1 billion of funding into startups in digital health in 2010, half of that in 2009. It was really made up of a bunch of companies from the Web 1.0, maybe Health 2.0 kind
yes.
of timing of 2006, 2007. What was it like that from your perch at as the United States CTO that you thought perhaps might be a different moment for the world?
It happened in the transition team. So at the president's election in 2008, I was on the transition team on this sort of brand new group that was writing the job description for the unknown chief technology officer to come. And among the most important things was the Recovery Act, which had to be organized immediately in the context of the response to the economic crisis. So during the transition team, we formed a mini startup. And who was involved? Todd Park, Farzad Mostashari, Danny Weitzner, who ultimately became my deputy at the White House, myself, and a young man who chose not to come into the administration, the only one of us who didn't, that's Dr. Peter Bash from MedStar Health. And we thought through a kind of a memo to the incoming National Coordinator for Health IT, first shaping the initial construct of the Recovery Act and then actually thinking about implementation. From day one, Steve, we thought that everything had to go hand in glove, that a tech modernization effort without the payment reform dimensions would have been useless. I mean, with all due respect to the HIT landscape at that time, it optimized for billing and documentation. These are not the things you'd optimize for in a world where you're trying to care for people up front. And so we didn't want to lard up the documentation and billing awesomeness people. We wanted to suggest that as we move to payment reform, we're going to need to have new technical underpinnings. And though we didn't use words like APIs or any specifics of what we're in the vernacular now, we envisioned these going hand in glove. And we basically asked the health reform team, even though the bill is not coming for the next round, kind of forecast where you think we're going to go so that we can kind of prepare for that in the Recovery Act. And that's exactly what I dusted off that old transition memo, and that I think is exactly where we've ended up. Not ossifying in yesterday's technology with subsidy, but ushering in. And one small sort of concept of this, it's why we made the meaningful use rule regulating modules, not integrated packages. This sounds really nerdy, but in this crowd that matters, because with modules you could have multiple substitutable parts that could plug in to whatever combination of technologies would ultimately be valued in the marketplace.
How long was that a big debate?
Of course, because at the time all the certification systems were all integrated certification models. And in fact, we had public testimony from some of the traditional vendors basically say, if you make us disconnect any aspect of our integrated package, then you will kill people because you will run risk that we can't manage the interconnection of multiple systems. And so what we ended up doing as a compromise was basically saying there's no wrong door. You can certify as an integrated package. You can certify as an individual module or a collection of modules. Or if you're the godfather John Halamka, who's the CIO at Beth Israel Deaconess, you can essentially certify on your own and piece together the moving parts.
So when you look at healthcare reform, and you talk a little bit about how all of it came together and what you were thinking about laying the groundwork for, today entrepreneurs, especially those in startup health, talk often about it being a treasure trove of opportunity, but yet so many people don't see it that way. How do you think we're doing in terms of progress over the last 4 or 5 years since it actually came to be?
I would say on three dimensions. One, if you look at the formula, which is the degree to which valuable data held by the government is now open, we're probably like a B towards a B plus. I mean, we've turned the default setting. Medicare couldn't publish anything, basically, because of this perceived constraint on this court case that said that we couldn't publish anything about physicians that would potentially reveal their salaries or what have you. All the way to now, we're like, Nile is on fire. The guy's publishing like every day new and interesting data sets. So on the opening up of government-held data, I think Bob Kocher, myself, Farzad, we and Todd, we had a dream that like the linked ABD claims file was the holy grail to release. And that's been made available through the Qualified Entity Program, but we're not like at the finish line of that being really, really in the hands of you folks to use. So we're like close, but we don't get an A because the QE program is still a kind of a pain in the neck. The shift to payment reform, I would have given us like a C plus on the rate. I mean, the law gives us massive freedom So if I see Jeremy's here from one of the health systems in New Jersey, if a doctor at his health system decided that he'd like to take or she'd like to take a bundled payment risk, but be very precise about they want risk for this pre and post interventional period, they could go to Medicare, petition that they run a trial, organize that trial, and if the actuary certified that the results of this trial validated improvements in quality and cost, we could actually scale that idea out. We didn't see the full weight of that legal authority until I think 2 weeks ago when the Pioneer ACO program became the first that the actuary officially certified for scaling up. And the reason it was a C plus is I don't think folks knew about it. If you polled the average doctor or hospital, hey, did you propose your idea of a payment reform model? They all thought like Moses would show up with tablets to say like this is how it'll be done, as opposed to having themselves have a voice in it. I think Secretary Burwell's statement earlier this year that we're going to get to 80% value-based payment in Medicare was like the stake in the ground we needed to jumpstart this movement. And so I think the C plus, whatever is moving to B minus, maybe even to A if we can exercise the muscles. And the last but most critical leg was the opening up of the valuable data. So it's cute to have your fun little wearable do something that's completely disconnected from the electronic health record or the care management platform, but that's not quite what we need in production. So this last leg has been how do we open up the data? And I think all the eyes are pointing towards one path through the patient, which is if every node is obligated to point the data back to the patient and the patient increasingly has apps and tools available that could use that information, we can really solve that last puzzle.
So if you could wave a magic wand, what would happen to make that happen?
I think what would happen right now is that every node in the system that's under HIPAA obligated to provide data back to the patient and voluntarily for those non-HIPAA covered entities who have sensitive data, if everyone agrees to allow their patients access to a machine-readable copy of their own data via API, then we'll start to see the emergence of connected apps that are doing what they're supposed to do. Right now we got an island of awesome apps in your community, and the degree to which they can plug and play with the legacy vendor at the health system or at the VA is really hard. And the meaningful use rules give us a kind of an option here. They say that patients have the right to designate a third-party app where they'd like to connect their summary file. We got to make that real. And my conclusion here is, those of you who follow this, the open API specs, a community of interest has formed around this, and at argonautproject.org, you can download and use all of the open API specs that's been all the HIT vendors plus a number of innovative health systems plus a number of IT companies all voluntarily coming together to say, it doesn't matter if you're a Cerner, Epic, Athena, Meditech patient portal. If the patient wants their data via API, they're going to get their meds list the same way, their problem list the same way, their vital signs the same way. So an app developer writes one app and in theory could consume with all those. So that's where we are right now.
And what Epic and Cerner signed on?
Epic and Cerner. So I love these tweets where it's like, oh, Epic and Cerner fighting each other every day in the battle royale of interoperability. In this example, they've come together. And, you know, we should welcome that and celebrate that. And as app developers, anyone here in the room have an app that's today using the Argonaut specs? Or they've only been out there for about a month, but you guys can build these things in a weekend. Anyone on Argonaut Project? Nate is involved. Where are you from?
RX Review.
Oh, of course, because I begged you guys to do it. Thank you. So you're awesome. We got to have you demo that soon. So that's the point. I think now we got to get the ecosystem to sort of say, hey, the vendors are on board. Let's dive.
Who's behind the Argonaut Project? Because it's come together, and in our circle, it's kind of a buzz. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about the background.
Yeah.
So you're involved in it.
So yeah, but the beauty of it was by design an unorganization. There's no charter. There's no company. There's no staff. There's no like one new platform to rule them all. Basically, the PCAST, the President's Advisors for Science and Tech in 2010, basically said something on the order of we should have an API in healthcare. We should move from a document-centric model to a data-centric model. And over the years, we've been talking about it. Esther's been celebrating and championing ideas like this. And basically, maybe 6 months ago, the Office of National Coordinator for Health IT got a final report from their advisors saying, you know what, in a unanimous vote, we agree healthcare should move to a common open API and point that API to the patient. It was a unanimous vote. Well, the question was, what API? Like, can anyone point to an API that's like standardized that everyone's going to use? It's like, well, there's the Open Epic people, and there's an whatever the Disrupt Me Now people, and whatever. But what if there was a common approach? So essentially, a group of us gathered in the fall and said, how much will it take to run a code and documentation sprint on top of the HL7 standards process? Can we accelerate? And we raised a little under $500,000 from folks who cared about this, Epic, Cerner, Meditech, the advisory board, where in disclosure, I'm an advisor, and others, and said, let's all open source everything. So the security specs are open sourced, the fire profiles are open sourced, and it's all run through HL7, so it's right in the glide path for balloting and approval, so you have confidence that this is not a fly-by-night operation.
So I want to segue a little bit to some of the difficulties that are still in front of all of us, the entrepreneurial community, but also the large corporations. In every other industry, entrepreneurs can ignore the big bureaucratic organizations, they can ignore the government, and they could just reinvent that industry. We saw it happen in music and travel and news and finance.
Taxis.
Yeah, in taxis, and delivery and all things. Healthcare, it takes collaboration. And we're at, Steve Case, one of our investors, just penned, I think it was in the Washington Post this
today.
Past week. Was it today? Or it was passed along, I think.
Whatever it was, it was awesome. Yeah. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It's in the Washington Post.
And talking about how this next phase of the internet is about collaboration. There's no shortage of entrepreneurs. There's now, we're tracking 7,500 startups around the world in digital health and wellness. There's a huge gap between those entrepreneurs and startups and these big organizations culturally resistant to change, in some cases not batteries included at all, but really not able to embrace external innovation in the way that's needed to actually get this job done. What can we do?
So just very briefly, this was the assignment the president handed me, because I would argue that not batteries included is kind of the DNA of traditional government. So when you come in as US CTO and the president's like, close the innovation gap, there's a little bit of an uh-oh. We have a culture of 3 million plus people in the federal civilian workforce. How do we move this machine? And the conclusion that I drew was that the answers were in how many in the private sector adopted what we would call open innovation, or for nerds out there, innovation pipeline management. That is to say, you've got to create a safe place for experimentation and innovation. And so for us, the idea was, if we could learn from the best, if we could say, look, we're going to open up our data, we're going to allow others to build products and services on top of that data, and we're going to allow for pilots, trials, challenges, one-offs that allow for those innovative new solutions to be brought back into the source of the organization, well, then we might have the kind of a circulatory system of innovation that welcomes and respects it. So what's needed is really the healthcare delivery system building up the capacity for innovation pipeline management. You don't want to have 0 to 60 overnight. Like, we're going to go to connected APIs on patient portals. So poor Jeremy here from Hackensack, tomorrow morning you're going to go live and every one of your patients can point their data via APIs to an app of their choice. He'd probably have a heart attack, because you got to manage this thoughtfully. You want to have a sort of a sandbox. So you could say, hey, we're going to offer a little, minimum viable product, Eric Ries, Lean Startup. Let's basically develop a little bit of prototyping capacity. But it's really a cultural thing. Does the CEO want this? Does the board encourage the CEO to pursue this?
And when they don't?
Well, that's the challenge. That the beauty of our healthcare delivery system is there's no one healthcare delivery company that rules them all. So there's like 4,000 hospitals in America. 800 are now in ACOs. So you just go to the next one and let them compete on who's more innovation friendly. And maybe Startup Health starts to come up with a bit of a crowdsourcing grading, yeah, of the health systems to say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how innovation friendly are they? And, did they host a codeathon? Have they purchased from a startup? In Startup America, the president tried to use this call to action to say things like, buy from a startup. Okay, I'm not saying what to buy. I'm just saying in your procurement, like, think about it. Oh, okay, well, maybe we should find a way to do that. And that's starting to seep in.
So you spent some time over the last year talking about your book, Innovation State.
Yes.
Watched a couple of those Jon Stewart interviews. I think he called you the Indian George Clooney?
Yeah.
Fascinating to have the platform that you've created to talk about such important work. How's it going? I want to talk about innovation state and what it means, and how do you think the government's doing in that regard?
You're very kind. It has nothing to do with me. I'm just commenting on the awesomeness that is Todd Park, who, by the way, the smartest thing that ever happened, if I had anything that ever I could celebrate, was begging the president to hire Todd Park to be the next CTO. That was probably the smartest thing that ever happened. Period. End of story. The idea of an innovative state is really of handshakes and handoffs, Steve. And the idea was very simple. Over the next decade, problems will be solved in health, in energy, in education. And it won't be because the agencies miraculously became innovative overnight. And it won't be because some disruptive force from the outside like took over the role of government in delivering unemployment benefits or whatever. That it's going to basically be a wholesaler role of government as like the market designer and maybe data supplier in wholesale fashion, but there'd be an increasingly vibrant, competitive private sector marketplace for retail services. And the analogy of that is really where we are today with healthcare.gov, which is, yes, you could go to healthcare.gov, but they've opened up the underlying marketplace data, so you can consume the healthcare marketplace API, and now Stride Health, who's presenting today or has already presented or whatever somewhere, are they in the back? Where's my band over there? So they can consume that data and build for Uber drivers a personalized recommendation service that allows those drivers to have a better shopping experience than if we simply told those drivers to go log into the better version of healthcare.gov 3.0. So they're not mutually exclusive. The idea of an innovative state is where you have both. You have a reasonably well-functioning healthcare.gov, thankfully, because you got an awesome U.S. digital services team and they've done this work. But then they've opened up the underlying interfaces so there can be an army of recommendations engines. So cat lovers love health insurance that prefer these kinds of providers.com may be an app on the system, and they may help you make better choices because that's the way we are. And in the virtuous cycle, to bring us full circle, now we start to get complaints. And I don't know if we've seen through Stride the specific complaint, but here's one. If you wanted to search by doctor, try shopping on healthcare.gov, search by doctor. You really can't. So if I wanted to say, show me the list of plans on the exchange, now that there are plans, that's great, but now I want to find the ones that my doctor's in, good luck. So in response to that feedback, the Obama administration said, okay, we're going to put a new rule. You got to open up the provider directory. And now we got to go back to the innovative state model and say, how are we going to actually get that data out? And so this virtuous cycle of philosophically connecting to the public and private sectors, where there's this debate and input on more open data sets and more rules for business models, I think that's the formula, Steve.
So today is about celebrating the healthcare transformers, the entrepreneurs that are getting up every day to fight the fight, to push that boulder up the mountain. We branded this community Healthcare Transformers, the entrepreneurs and innovators doing the work. What is your advice to them? Because there is no shortage of batteries not included people they interface with every day. We try our best to do what you're describing, which is help them identify which organizations and which people are batteries included, which are open to external innovation, which are the good ones versus the bad ones. But what's your advice for the next 5 years, 10 years, as we all reimagine this industry? What do they need to know?
Well, first, the president's got your back. The country is cheering you on. And to put the fear of God in you, your failure will destroy the country. And here's what I mean by that. Everywhere I go in the public stage, the fight is, we need more money for climate change. We need more money for better teachers. We need universal preschool. We need whatever. The single biggest reason we don't have those things, healthcare costs. It's not a deficit problem of broad proportions. It is a healthcare cost problem. And if we constrain the rate of growth in healthcare just a little bit more, my friend Zeke Emanuel calls this GDP plus zero. If we get to GDP plus zero on healthcare costs, we essentially wipe out the deficit, freeing up all this capital so that our kids can live a cleaner, healthier life. And so it's not just about fixing the healthcare industry and becoming a billionaire in that process, which you should do, and we'll celebrate. President will like honor you, he'll fly out and like shake your hand and do all these amazing things. But literally the fate of the world rests on our collective ability to constrain healthcare costs while improving value. And that will likely happen through your efforts, more so than the machinery itself just discombobulating and if reforming itself. It will need your DNA, your enthusiasm, your batteries, they're not even batteries. You've got the Tesla battery pack in this room. This is what's fueling you guys. So my humble opinion, eye on the prize. We've got your back from a public policy standpoint, but your success is so desperately needed for the country.
That is fantastic. Does anybody have any questions? I want to see if before we wrap up, I want to see if the audience has any questions. Yay? Nay?
They want to hear the Startup Showcase. No more lecturing from folks like me.
Exactly.
Anish,
you have for the last 5 or 6 years since you took over your CTO, you have been the ultimate of healthcare transformers.
Hardly.
This community proudly wears a pin.
Oh.
Everyone who's a healthcare transformer has one. I would like to pin you officially with the healthcare transformer pin.
We'll do that right now.
Thank you for everything you've done and continue to do to help this community.
Cheers.
He's for president.
Yeah, whatever. Thank you. All right.